Monday, the 4th of April, calling the House Water Committee into session. First item on the agenda is going to be to open a work session on House Bill 3038. And first item there for us is to ask Mr. Sussman to come up, please. Good afternoon, Adam.
Good afternoon. For the record, Adam Sussman with the Water Resources Department. Mr. Chair, I do have some written testimony that I prepared a week or so ago, and with your permission, I'd like to enter it into the record.
That'll be fine.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For our information, Adam has been with us for the two public hearings that we've had on this particular bill, and he's listened to that testimony as well as been, I think, a part of the work group that the League of Oregon Cities et al. Had been involved in trying to bring forth this legislation or this proposal. And I would ask, Adam, that you kind of update us as to the status, position, I guess the position of the department and your observation of the amendments, dash one and dash two, and I understand there is likely to be a dash three here today, we'll deal with that portion when we get there. Go ahead, please.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. And that was my intention to kind of stand back a little bit and try to pull some of this together, because you have heard quite a bit of testimony. And for the record, I just want to make sure, first off, that I say that the department does support House Bill 3038 with the dash one amendments that you have seen previously. And I think it's important for the committee to understand, in terms of putting this in context, that about 95% of this bill and the issues surrounding this bill has to do with Section 5 of the bill, which is the applicability. And in my opinion, the other 5 or 10% of the bill has to do with how we handle new permits and the question of whether they get 10 years or 20 years into the future. And why is Section 5 so important? Well, the reason Section 5 of the bill is so important is because for many years the department has interpreted the permit development statutes to not apply strictly to municipalities. In other words, we did not require construction of municipal use permits with any specific time frame. And we did that for many, many years. And as you heard, because of a recent court case that laid down the opinion that was not an appropriate way to interpret the law, there are many municipal water suppliers out there that are holding permits that are quite concerned about the validity of that permit. These are entities that have relied on the department's actions and in good faith have relied on the future development of those permits. And in fact, it was with the department's blessing that these permits, this list of permits that you saw, has been held by municipalities for future growth to ensure that they had adequate redundancy in their system. They're being used for regional problem solving and emergencies. And so there's a lot of permit holders out there in that situation. I think you've heard some of the folks that are testifying calling these permits that are being held bad water management, and others have called it sound planning.
You said there are a lot of those out there. Do you have any specifics Can you speak to what a lot means and where they come from and what type of issues are present in them?
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if you recall, in the testimony of Water Watch of Oregon, they provided a list of permits that were yet to be developed. And my recollection is that there was about 250 of those permits on their list. That's not the complete list, however, and there's probably over 300 municipal permits in the state that have yet to be certificated. And I think that the thing that you need to remember when you look at that list, and I think as Ms. Russell clarified, is that there's a lot of stories you can tell with that list. Some of these permits are have requested a certificate from the department, about 50 to 60 of those, and they're waiting for the department to take action on that. A number of them may be fully developed or close to fully developed and just haven't gone through the process of requesting a claim of beneficial use. Some of them may be strictly for emergency purposes. For example, if you depend on a watershed with a road close by where an oil tanker could, you know, spill off the road into your watershed, it would be good planning to ensure that you had a backup water supply in that eventuality, either surface water or groundwater. And then some of them are just permits that eventually are being grown into over time. So, Mr. Chair, there's kind of a lot of stories I think you can tell about each one of those permits that are on the list. And again, I think that what you heard is some people would call those permits poor water management on the part of the state, and others would call that good planning of the local community. So, I mean, that's the debate I think we're having.
In your estimation, or in your working with these, are there of this N that we have, are there some of them that perhaps Water Watch et al., as well as the department and the cities would concede are good management issues, and am I making my question clearer with that? And I realize you can't speak for Water Watch. I'm not asking you to do that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would hope we could look at that list and stand back and agree in some cases that those permits that are being grown into or that are part of a redundancy make sense. But I think there's a lot of them that we could look at it and not agree on.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, I think if I can continue that, so we're really focusing on the applicability section 5, because we're really talking about the permits that are out there and the concern about the validity of those permits. But what this bill really does, and what we heard over the last couple days, is that this bill really provides an opportunity to rehash an issue that the department and the parties in this room spent 4 years talking about, and we're really revisiting.
How long?
4 years, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And that issue is when a permit extension is granted, and you'll find some of this background in my written testimony, is that the ultimate question that the department needs to evaluate is whether there is good cause for granting that extension. And for 4 years, starting in about 1998, we worked with a work group called the Community Water Supply Work Group that negotiated and resolved this issue. And let me stand back and kind of give you some context of why we went there. In 1997, there was an opinion by the Attorney General's office that suggested one could interpret the statute to allow the department, in granting an extension, to look at competing demands in between and among water users in a system. And we initiated a rulemaking effort to adjust our rules to that advice. And at the same time, the municipalities made it quite clear that kind of analysis didn't really work for them, given the unique circumstances that they were in terms of having a plan for the future and beginning construction and financing and planning. They couldn't, 15 or 20 years down the road, have the rug pulled out from under them, so to speak. And so we, the department, recognizing sort of the unique needs of municipalities and how they develop their permits, we initiated this work group. The issues that you heard raised by Water Watch then, in 1998 and now, about good stewardship of the state's water resources is extremely important. I mean, it's extremely important to the department in terms of how we do our business. And in fact, you've heard the department come to this committee on numerous occasions to talk about our resource stewardship activities and activities that we're doing to voluntarily restore and protect stream flow in the state of Oregon. And similarly, the issues raised by the water suppliers that you've heard about the need for certainty, the need to plan, is also extremely important. And in fact, both of those make up the department's mission, dual mission of ensuring we have adequate water supply and at the same time ensuring we're protecting the state's resources. So after the department, including a subcommittee of the Water Resource Commission, wrestled with this issue for 4 years, the way we ultimately came to a balance in how we balance those desires and resource needs, we came up with a program. And you've heard a little bit about that program. And again, I want to reiterate, this was a big effort by the department, 4-year effort to come up with a way to balance these needs. And again, what we're doing now is really revisiting how the department ultimately concluded that negotiation. And I don't want to give you the impression that everybody walked away from that negotiation happy. Obviously, some weren't, and that's why some are here requesting to revisit that. But under the program, all of the holders of the undeveloped permits that we talked about are going to need to get an extension of time, okay? They're going to need to come through the department, darken our door, and get an extension of time that demonstrates a reasonable amount of time to continue the development of this permit. It's going to require them to show demand projections, consideration of other water rights that they hold, and plans for how they're going to use water in the future. So that's going to be the first step at the Water Resource Department. And I want to make it clear that this program that we've developed is a significant hook, if you will, that the department did not have prior to working with these municipalities that hold these permits to go through this program. And I think the one thing we've talked about, and I want to make sure the committee understands that, is that once the department grants this extension, no water beyond what they're already beneficially using can be used from that permit until the entity develops a water management and conservation plan that's approved by the department. And again, this is a great opportunity for the departments to work cooperatively with the water suppliers of the state to develop a very rigorous plan for how they're going to conserve and manage the state's waters. And again, I said that, you know, the plan's rigorous. It includes things like benchmarks for conservation, periodic check-ins, analysis of alternatives, and a whole bunch of other stuff that no other water user in the state of Oregon has to do. And that, again, was part of the program. Maybe this competing demands thing doesn't work, but some...
Thanks, Elder.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Adam, I have a question about how many water conservation management plans currently have been adopted and approved by the department? I just would like to have a sense, because this only started in 1998, is that correct?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Dingfelder, there's really... I think for clarification, there might be two kinds of plans. One is a plan that may have been a permit condition or some other condition of water use in the past. The plans I'm talking about are the ones that need to articulate the need for additional water over periods of time. Of the latter that I'm talking about, to date, we've had only 3 of those plans submitted and approved by the department. Now, the rules were adopted for this program in, it was either October or November of 2002, and the municipalities don't need to submit that plan until after the permit extension. In fact, they have 3 years to do it. So we have about 30 municipalities who have received an extension who, within the next 3 years, if they want access to any more water than they're currently using, will have to have an approved water management and conservation plan.
Follow up. Thank you, Adam. And if a permit extension has already been issued prior to that date, the only trigger where they would have to do a water conservation management plan, I'm asking this to see if I'm understanding this right, would be if they come back for another extension. Is there any other hook? In other words, once the extension has been issued and say they're not going to need another extension, does that mean that they wouldn't have to do a water conservation management plan?
Chair Jensen and Representative Dingfelder, I think under this, I'm going to try to answer it the best I can, but under this program, I believe we're going to capture the majority of the municipal and quasi-municipal water providers under this new program, and I'll tell you why. And that's because in 1997, when we got the advice from the Attorney General's office and we started this rulemaking and negotiation, most of the permits that expired, if you will, and needed an extension just sort of remained in kind of this on-hold pattern. And so we're really at a place where we're beginning to go through almost all of the undeveloped municipal permits. And I say that with a caveat. There may have been some that somehow got an extension sort of in that interim period and moved through. And at that, in those cases, we would be able to use our hook when they came back for another permit extension. And I don't know how many of those there are, but I would assume it's very few.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I love the way you people talk about the people of the state of Oregon out there having to have hooks. I didn't know we were fishing today. I hope those hooks conform to the same qualifications that they do for fishing the endangered species of the waters of this state. Please proceed.
And Mr. Chair, probably a better way to describe that would be an opportunity rather
Thank
than
you.
A hook. And it is a great opportunity that we relish. I want to make a couple other points about the process, because I think some may have testified that there really is very little public involvement, if you will. And this water management and conservation plan process that I'm talking about does provide ample opportunity to comment on the plan, on all of the elements included in the plan, and in fact provides an opportunity to appeal the approval of that plan to the Water Resources Commission. So if there's an environmental organization or any kind of other organization that feels that the department or the water user is not towing the line in terms of water management, water conservation, there is an appeal process and there is an on-ramp into that process. And so, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, really after 2 days of testimony that you've heard for maybe an hour and a half each time, again, I think you're facing the same issues that we faced as an agency and as a Water Resources Commission that we spent 4 years working through and resolving and developing the program that we have. We think it's a good program, and we think, frankly, it's too early to call it a failure. And we think it's reasonable to give our program for how we evaluate good cause for municipalities some more time to develop and provide the benefits that we think it's going to provide.
Are you through?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Well, that was a fairly abbreviated for all of. Why did all of the other people have spent so much more time?
Efficient.
I mean, we could have heard this in one public hearing and been out of here. Other questions for the department? We're going to stand at ease for a few few minutes. Questions here for you, Adam.
Yes.
And I'd like to have you look at, and I know you probably have done this already, but explain to me, you know, what's in, as far as the department is concerned, what is in the Dash 2 amendments, and why you like the Dash 2 amendments, and or if you dislike them.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I do have the Dash 2 amendments, so I'll just kind of walk through them as we go here. As you have indicated, Mr. Chair, you know, I'm looking at about line 11 of the Dash 2 amendments where there's a suggestion that the development timelines for a new municipal permit would be limited to 10 years. And my experience of working with the municipalities and understanding their needs and their land use requirements and other kinds of requirements is that that number should be 20 years as a minimum, and that seems to make sense to me and the department. There's also a suggestion in the Dash 2 amendments, lines 14 through 18, particularly where the Dash 2 amendments would impose a time limit on a permit extension of 10 years. And again, Mr. Chair, we as a department and as a work group wrestled with this issue for 4 years and concluded that under the current law, the best way to handle this is to give the municipality the time that they can demonstrate that's reasonably necessary to fully develop the use and spend less time focusing on multiple extensions over time and focus the department's resources and the entity's resources on developing a water management and conservation plan that only makes the water available to them upon demonstrating through a rigorous analysis that it's needed and that it's being used in the most effective conservation-oriented way possible. I'm now kind of towards the bottom of page 19, and this, I'm sorry, page 1, and this gets a little complicated, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, where beginning on line 1, it talks about in determining whether there's good cause for the extension, the department shall consider, and then it goes on to list a number of factors on page 1 and page 2, some of them with capital letters, A, B, C, and then some with small I, and so on, all the way down to line 22. Under current law, for all permit extensions, whether it's municipal, quasi-municipal, irrigation, industrial, when the department is evaluating good cause, the way the statute is written is it suggests that the department consider the factors in ORS 539.010 sub 5. And those factors that are in that body of law have to do with things you should be thinking about as you're considering whether there's diligent development of this permit. The way the Dash 2 amendments are written is that rather than referring to that statute as it currently does, it lists them. With big A, B, C, D, and E on pages 1 and 2. So that's a different approach to what the current law, to the way the current law is set up. And it also is different than the written bill, House Bill 3038, in that it simply says the department shall consider good cause and does not refer you to Chapter 539. So from the department's sort of administrative point of view, it is a little bit confusing. Either one of these are kind of confusing. The bill as written is confusing because it doesn't refer to Chapter 539, and all other permit extensions would. And so that could be a bit of confusion. the dash 2 amendments as written are also confusing because in one place it refers to Chapter 539 and the factors, and in another place it actually lists them out. So in either case, Mr. Chair, I think it's causing a little bit of confusion.
The thorn in your side.
Good old what's her name down here, huh? It's a good old what's her name.
Little inside joke from Friday. Okay, Adam, question is, are you opposed to having that Section 539 language in the bill? I mean, if it's the same, I mean, I understand what you're saying. The dash ones don't refer to that section. The dash twos are not identical. Is that what you're saying? They're not identical to the rule? So conceptually, are you opposed to having that language that's in rule in the statute? If that's what you're doing already, de facto, through rulemaking.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dingfeld, I want to be really careful how I answer this because some of these things are in rule, some are in statute, some are in both, and they're worded differently. Okay, so I want to be clear about that. But what I would say is that the department would not be opposed if, for example, line 21 said, in determining whether there is good cause for the extension, the Water Resources Department shall, and then use the same language as you would use for any other permit extension, which is give due weight to the considerations described under ORS 539-010 sub 5 and to other governmental requirements. Because if you look, Mr. Chair and Representative Dingfelder, on page 3 of the dash 2 amendments, and you look at page 3, lines 11 through 14, that's the language that's used for any other permit extension. And I want to add one other point about this is that I can understand the desire in the written bill of simply just saying good cause and letting the department define that because we're spending a lot of time bickering, frankly, with certain organizations about what exactly the good cause determination should look like. And so, on the one hand, we can leave it the same, and we can continue fighting about it. The department thinks that they've interpreted the statute and applied it in an appropriate fashion. Or we could have it in the bill as written, which simply gives the department complete discretion to define good cause, and we can stop fighting about that. And then I would imagine Water Watch's perspective would be, or we could define good cause as they have on page 2, lines 4 through 19, and from their perspective, we could stop fighting about it in terms of how good cause applies. But I guess the bottom line, Mr. Chair, is the department would not be opposed to having the language on page 1 of the dash 2s mirror the language on page 3 of the dash 2 amendments.
But, Adam, excuse me, Representative.
No, I'm finished. Thank you.
Wouldn't that conflict with the motto of this committee if we get everybody to stop fighting about this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, if we simply, I want to make sure that my answer is clear again, because I think this gets really confusing, is that if we simply referred to the factors in 539-010 sub 5, and then on page 2, that would, of course, just eliminate the need to have all the large capital A, B, C, D, and E would not be necessary in the dash 2 amendments, because those are simply the factors that you would be looking at in the statute. And even with that, Mr. Chair, there'd be plenty to fight over, because when you go and you look at those factors in terms of what does the market and present demand mean, there's not necessarily agreement on how that would be interpreted. Does that help? I mean, it's a long answer for a really small part of the bill, but it is important. Now, again, on page 2 of the dash 2 amendments, if you look at lines 4 through 19, those are the proponents of this amendment's desire for how we would interpret applying the market and present demand analysis for any permit extension. Okay? This goes back to the heart of my testimony that I provide. I'm on page 2 of the dash 2 amendments. Again, lines 4 through 19.
Thank you.
These are the factors that when the department is doing a permit extension for anybody other than a municipal and quasi-municipal water provider, we put them through this analysis. But again, going back to the heart of my testimony, we developed a different program for the municipal water providers that does not include evaluating these factors. And so this would be inconsistent with the program we've developed.
Go ahead.
Okay. The other things that I would comment on the dash 2 amendments, I'm now looking at the bottom of page 2, line 27, this concept that the permit extension would be conditioned to ensure that there's no more additional water use until a water management and conservation plan is written. There's a subtle difference in the way the dash 2 amendments are written as compared to the written bill. And that is, it talks about beyond the maximum amount of water beneficially used before the extension. And we've always referred to this as the maximum rate diverted for beneficial use. There's an important but subtle difference here, and that is that a municipality, as a really wild example, may have a 10-foot wide pipe to divert water into a storage facility, and then the storage facility may have a 6-inch pipe that's used to supply water. And so we always think of it in terms of the rate that the water is diverted from the creek rather than the amount that is being beneficially used. So that's just a subtle difference between how the department would view this issue. And again, that same question of amount is on page 3, line 1 of the dash 2 amendments. I also, in looking at the dash 2 amendments, lines 1 through 5, this concept that the permit extension would be conditioned to ensure, you know, in my own words, that the permit holder is towing the line in terms of the things that they have said they will do in their water management conservation plan. We already have a provision in our program rules that provide the department an opportunity to evaluate this and, in fact, not allow additional diversion if they're not towing the line.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Do we have a copy of those rules? I'm not sure to whom I should address this, either to you, Mr. Chair, or to you, Adam. You refer to the rules, and I have no idea what those rules are.
Chair Jensen, Representative Tomei, I have not provided the committee a copy of the rules. So the rules I'm talking about are both the permit that are both part of the program that I discussed earlier, are the permit extension rules of the Water Resources Commission, and then the Water Management and Conservation Plan rules from the Water Resources Commission. And when Mr. Tiffany and his group testified, they provided you a guidebook, if you will, that they had developed for developing these plans. And in that guidebook, I would assume in one of the appendices are the rules. But and the
that LOC developed, not your department. Is that correct?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, the League of Oregon Cities developed the guidebook to help the municipalities go through the process of developing the plan, but it was the Water Resources Commission that actually adopted the administrative rules that need to be followed in developing that guidance.
Follow up. Can you give us an example of one or two of the rules that they're expected to follow?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, this is just an example right here. This is in OAR 690-86-150, and this is under the Municipal Water Supply Conservation element. And this is sub 4, description. So in part of their plan, they would need to give a description of the specific activities along with a schedule that establishes 5-year benchmarks for implementing each of the following conservation measures that are required. And then it gives a list of things. For example, an annual water audit that includes a systematic and documented method for estimating any unmetered and unauthorized use. A program to install meters on all unmetered water service connections. And I'm not reading it verbatim here. The meter program shall start immediately after the plan is approved and shall identify the number of meters to be installed each year. A meter testing and maintenance program, a rate structure under which customers' bills are based at least on part on the quantity of water that they divert. If the audit indicates system leakage of greater than 10%, a regularly scheduled and systematic program to detect leaks in transmission and distribution system, a public education program to encourage efficient water use.
That's great. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Tomei, what I was referring to earlier is that the Commission's rules, as we grant additional opportunities to access water under the municipal permit, one of the rules provides that we can evaluate to what extent the water user is meeting the benchmarks and making the decision as to whether they should have access to more water. So essentially what lines 1 through 5 in the Dash 2 amendments are in a sense codifying what we already have in administrative rule, using some different words, essentially.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Grounds.
Yeah, Adam, if you have these rules, they're formed to develop these water management plan. Is there any teeth in them where you can make them follow the plan that they develop, or do they just develop a plan and put it on the shelf? And
Mr. Chair and Representative Brown, they do have teeth, and I won't call it a hook. Again, I'll call it an opportunity. These rules really provide us, and this program really provide us an opportunity, because if you recall, the permit extension extends the time you have to develop the permit. But the Water Management and Conservation Plan is the vehicle that the department uses to determine how much water you can access over time. And so if you're not being a good player and you're not following your Water Management and Conservation Plan and you're not meeting your benchmarks and you're not attempting to meet your benchmarks, the department's in a position to say, I'm sorry, you can't develop more of this permit until you show us that you're serious about water management and water conservation. There also is, in the rules that I refer to, an enforcement section and has a whole list of opportunities that the department has in terms of enforcement action. And, in fact, it talks about we can assess a civil penalty and we could cancel a permit according to these rules. So we hope we don't get there. We would like to work cooperatively with the water users, as always, but there are tools there, Representative Brown.
Mr. Chair, I know I join the ranks with Representative Dingfelder being a thorn in his side, but
because she wasn't there.
Good cause. I want to get back to that. And one of my pet peeves, of course, is the city of Adair Village. So if Adair Village is wanting to sell water to Corvallis or somebody else, so how would they show good cause? Would they show good cause that Corvallis needs the water? They're not having to show good cause that they need the water. They're just having to show good cause that somebody in Oregon needs the water, or maybe not in Oregon for that matter.
Mr. Chair and Representative Tamami, that's an excellent question, and there's kind of two answers to it. One is that I want to make it very clear, I'm trying to find it here, that the legislature has already adopted a body of law that provides great flexibility for the use of municipal water rights. And in fact, there's a statute, it's ORS 540-510, and I actually have copies of it if the committee so desires. And it talks about in the statute that any water used under a permit or certificate issued to a municipality may be used places where it's not pertinent, where it's not attached, if, and then it lays out a number of provisions. And one is it says that the use continues to be for municipal purpose and would not interfere with other water rights. So I'll get to the specific answer, but the larger question is sort of a matter of legislative policy. The legislature has recognized that municipal water rights should be freely shared in order to resolve regional water problems. Okay, and this statute, again, sub 3 on the page that you're looking at, sort of provides that flexibility. So with that context, Representative Tomei, I think under the rules that we've developed for our program, that I think it's quite conceivable that the city of Adair Village can come in and say, well, we have this water right. We're thinking about entering into an intergovernmental agreement with Polk County, who needs the water. We're talking with the city of Corvallis, the city of Albany as backup. Here's letters demonstrating that they have a need for this water, and we think it'll take 47 years under this thought process to fully develop the right. Under the program and the rules that we have, that would be enough to conclude that there's good cause for allowing the extension. But I think, again, I want to emphasize very strongly that that's only the first stop. So now they have a permit extension, which allows them time to continue the development of the permit, but they cannot access one additional drop of water beyond what they're already diverting until they would develop a water management and conservation plan to show in a very rigorous way the need within like a 5-year, 10-year, 20-year horizon about how that water is going to be used, who's going to use it, how they're going to manage it, and how it's going to be conserved. So it is sort of a two-stop process, and that would be an example of how an Adair Village might be able to continue the development of the permit. But again, you can look at Adair Village's activities in two different ways. You can look at it as bad water management, or you can look at it as regional water problem solving. And again, I think Adair Village, I mean, we talk about it a lot, is probably an anomaly. It is not. Hopefully Adair Village is not what we're making the state's public policy around, because I believe it is an anomaly. But again, I think they have an opportunity to use that water in a beneficial way for municipal purposes.
So let's say that Vancouver, Washington has a real use in the municipality for this water. So could Adair Village sell their water to the city of Vancouver?
Mr. Chair and Representative Tomei, the good thing is that the legislature has also had the foresight to talk about what kind of restrictions might apply when water leaves the state of Oregon. So there's a whole process that would need to go through, which I'm not familiar exactly with all the terminology, but in some cases I know it even requires legislative approval for water to leave the state in some cases. So it's not quite that freely transferred.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Other questions? Karen, would you come up, please? Just hang around if you would.
Yeah.
And I think you have a base 3 amendment that you probably have killed some trees with today. Would you explain to us briefly or basically the distinction between the dash 2 and the dash 3 amendments, both of which originated from your office, if I understand correctly?
Yes. Chair Jensen, members of the committee, my name is Karen Russell, and I'm senior staff attorney with Water Watch of Oregon. The Dash 3 amendments attempt to clarify, I think I hadn't had much of a chance to look at the Dash 2 before we handed those out, and our intent by the Dash 2 amendments, and now is clarifying the Dash 3, is to make the language related to good cause mirror the existing language in the statute, one of the points that Adam had made. So if you look at the Dash 3 amendments, page 1, subsection 2, still section 1, subsection 2, lines 14 and 16, still retain the 10-year time period for initial permit and then a time limit on extensions. That hasn't changed. But the language in lines 19 through 24 and then continuing on to the next page, I believe more closely follow existing statute in terms of the good cause determination and what the department considers. So it would say, in determining there is good cause for the extension, the Water Resources Department shall give due weight to the considerations described in ORS 539010 sub 5 and to whether other governmental requirements relating to the project have significantly delayed completion of construction. So instead of taking 539010 and inserting it at that section of the statute, it's just referring to that. Now, the next sentence, which says, in determining the market and present demand for water or power to be supplied, the department shall consider at a minimum those factors below, so it would be capital A through F, were taken from the Water Resources Department's rule, which interprets the statutory standard of market and present demand for water. And actually, right now, as I understand the department's rule, the department requires that it consider these factors for all water use permits coming up for extension, including municipal and quasi-municipal permits with priority dates after November of 98. So only some of those old permits, don't have to be considered in light of these factors. And I wanted to clarify that. So the department, in its rules, didn't just say municipalities have a special situation that they're in, and therefore we're going to carve all municipalities out of this kind of consideration. They only carved out the old permits, permits that, when they are developed, will have the most likelihood of having an effect on other water users in the watershed. So this language is not Water Watch's language in the sense that it's the Water Resources Department's language from their rule. So it's attempting to make certain that those factors are looked at. And then the remaining language, I believe, remains the same, with the exception of on the bottom of page 2, lines 27 through 29, and I'm still working with the Legislative Council on this concept, but the idea that we were trying to get at, I think the old language in the Dash 2 amendment say goals in the conservation statute or conservation plan. This says require a finding by the department when they're making an extension decision that any incremental water conservation measures in the permit holder's approved water conservation and management plan are met or will be achieved. What we were trying to say is, in those conservation plans, the water permittee sets benchmarks of what they think they can achieve in terms of conservation. The state doesn't come up with those benchmarks. Water Watch doesn't come up with those benchmarks. The permittee does. The department reviews them and then approves them. And so what we are trying to get at with this language is that the department's making some finding that those water users, when they're making a decision to allow more time to develop this permit, are meeting those benchmarks, have met those benchmarks, or will be meeting them within a time certain. And one of the things, the conservation management and planning rules are a good step forward for Oregon and conservation for municipal use. But it doesn't get at the impact of these developments on competing demand. So to me, the conservation plan is a good thing in terms of public policy and trying to encourage conservation, but it ignores competing demands. And the other concern that we have about the conservation planning rules is that the rules allow those benchmarks to be moved around if it's, I'm going to say inconvenient, but the language in the rule is essentially if it's inconvenient for the permittee and the department agrees. And frankly, the department in its past conservation planning process spent a lot of time rolling over inadequate plans that didn't meet standards. And so the track record that the department has had in terms of enforcing even benchmarks that permittees are putting forward is not to really hold people's feet to the fire, but to allow people to slide them. And so what we were trying to do by this language was firm up those benchmarks. And again, WaterWatch doesn't set the benchmarks. It's the permittee coming forward with these plans, working with the department on what they can achieve in terms of conservation. And we'd like to see the benchmarks be as solid as possible. If the state is going to be making a commitment of a public resource, more time to develop that resource. So I think the remainder of the amendments, the similar changes in Dash 1 are mirrored, the similar changes in Section 1 are mirrored in Section 2 because Section 1 deals with surface water, Section 2 deals with groundwater. And so those are the changes. Some of them address, I think, Adam's concern, especially lines 19 through 24 on page 1 and part of line 1 on page 2. Again, that's mirroring the existing statutory language in the statute.
Karen, were you involved in the work group that met? You were involved in the work group that met for 4 years dealing with these issues starting back in 1998. Is that correct?
Chair Jensen, members of the committee, yes, we were. And we have taken the position, I think we've taken the position before this committee also, that we understand municipalities need to plan, and there's a way to do it that is good policy in Oregon that's going to protect Oregon's rivers and give them the security that they need. And in that, those proceedings, we weren't able to agree on what that vision should look like. And we view the existing rules that have this carve-out of an exception for these old permits as not consistent with the law as it stands today. And I guess I just want to say that this bill is far-reaching because it's taking permits that are supposed to be developed within 5 years, which has been the law for 100 years, and saying you now have 20 years to develop your use.
Russell, one could make an argument, it seems to me, and a fairly legitimate argument, that it also has 100 years of precedent of being interpreted that way so that those exceptions could be made. And only because of recent, starting I think in 96 or 97, AG's opinions has that been altered. So, I mean, this kind of can work both ways, it seems to me, when we start trying to get into that murky water.
And I guess, Chair Jensen, members of the committee, business as usual doesn't give the munis the certainty that they need, but it's also not protecting other water users in a watershed. So what we've been trying to do with these amendments is figure out a way, and, you know, obviously we haven't had an agreement yet that we got there, but I guess I would just ask this committee to be thinking about a way to meet their needs in a way that's going to still require consideration of other water users in a watershed when we're making these kinds of commitments. And, you know, you can, I always have to argue, but, you know, as a member of the public, I would assume that the department would be enforcing the law. And because they haven't, you know, and I have an expectation that they should have been enforcing the law, I guess there's expectations on all sides, and it would be nice to figure out a way to address their needs in a way that would protect other water users in a watershed, and we don't think that balance has been reached.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Falco.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3038.
Representative Falco has moved the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3038. Is there discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
Interchangeable.
I mean, we've got to arrange some way to get the two of you closer to me so that I can
Mr.
Chair. Thorn on each side.
Once again, I will take that as a compliment. But I have some concerns about the Dash 1s for some of the reasons that both of the people sitting up at the dais have already articulated. I think the department talked about referring to Chapter 539 about the good cause determination. I had concerns that that was not defined. So, however that gets defined, it's defined in the Dash 2s and 3s. I think it's clearer in the Dash 3s. So that was a concern I had. I think I had mentioned to you earlier that I had a concern about Section 5, which basically says any permits were issued prior to 2005, the date of this act, are validated, and I had concerns about that. I think I mentioned that to you several weeks ago. And then also I'm concerned about still allowing open-end extensions with the Dash 1s. I also want to say, and I should have said this first, that I really appreciate, because I've been working with all the parties that you've heard from pretty intensely for the past, I'd say, 3 weeks. It seems like it's been more like 3 years. And I just want to say my appreciation to Willie Tiffany from League of Oregon Cities, Karen Russell from Water Watch, and Adam Sussman, who have, I think, given a very good faith effort to try to come to agreement. And as we know, it's been trying and difficult, and these are very hot-button issues, as we all know. Water's for fighting, whiskey's for drinking. And I don't think that's going to change overnight, but I just want to say that I appreciate the work that has gone into this and the fact that the parties have been willing to sit down and work together, and I think that goes a long way. However, I don't think we're there yet, so that's why I will be a no vote on the Dash 1s.
Okay. Representative Barnard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendments as a substitute for the Dash 1 amendments, and I'd like to speak to that if I may.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm not pleased, frankly, with any of the amendments we have in front of us. I think I'll adopt most of the arguments of Representative Dingfelder around these issues. I'll criticize the Dash 3s because they're the ones I'm moving. I'm not really happy with the 10-year limit. I think the 20-year limit, which conforms more to the land use planning rules, makes more sense to me. But I believe that for the other reasons that Representative Dingfelder mentioned, the Dash 3s actually are an improvement over the Dash 1s because of the cause issues that she raised, and also...
Mr. Chair,
Representative...
Point of order.
Point of order. Take your coin.
I'm not sure that it is appropriate for the representative from Eugene to move the Dash 3s in place of the Dash 1s. In terms of Mason's standard, I believe that the motion on the Dash 1s has to either come to a resolution or must be dispensed with in some way before a subsequent motion for the Dash 3s can be made.
we will stand at ease for a moment to get a clarification of your point of order from the Chief Clerk. And Chief Clerk has explained that we're still within the jurisdiction of the committee. We've not strayed too far away from parliamentary or Mason's rules here, so that we can proceed. And if you would proceed, please, Representative Barnhart.
So, Mr. Chair, just to clarify, the ruling of the chair is that the motion's in order.
The motion to replace or to substitute the -3 for the -1 is accepted.
That's an
accepted Mason's motion.
Okay, then if I understand it, where we are in the debate is that I was explaining my reasons for favoring the -1s over the -3s.
Your discussion is for the -3 amendment.
Yes, sir, and I'd like to continue that if I may.
Yeah, that's what I just opened.
Actually, I'd like him to continue his support for the -1s.
Thank you.
We appreciate that, but we'll wait for that.
Right. Thank you. The dash one amendments are lacking in the areas that Representative Dingfelder already mentioned. I'm not going to repeat those, and I think the -3s very adequately deal with those issues. And we've had some very careful explanations of the ways in which those special issues are dealt with. And I think they answer a number of the questions Representative Tomei asked at our last hearing about what do you do with water rights that are sitting out there that are obsolete, that belong to communities that may not even exist anymore, or things of the like. So the -3s are simply a lot clearer in their instructions to the department about how it's to behave. The only problem I really have with the -3s has to do with the 10-year limit, and I think that's something that's pretty easily fixed with another amendment, or even potentially on the Senate side. That's the reason why I would support the 3s over the 1s, and I think that concludes my remarks. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Let me comment just a little bit on the -3s. Though I've had some overture of one of my concerns, I thought it was relatively clear that the chair was not going to be look with favor on a 10-year extension. He believes that that's contradictory to land use policies that we have in the state with 20-year extensions, and would like to have consistency in anything with that. And in addition, the chair would be concerned in the Section 5 of the -3 amendments, which does not do what the original bill, original amendments proposed to do. So with that, would you call the roll? And we're moving the -3s to substitute for the -1s.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Brown?
No.
Representative Belto?
No.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Vice Chair Dingfelder?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kremel?
No.
Chair Jensen?
No. Having failed to receive a majority, the motion to substitute the -3s for the -1s fails. And we are back now to discussion on the -1 amendment.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Cromwell.
I will support the -1 amendments. I realize that it's pretty much a rewrite of the bill. Well, it is a rewrite of the bill. I'm satisfied from a standpoint of looking at the administrative rule with regards to some of the issues that Water Watch has brought up being addressed in rule, and quite frankly don't see a reason for those to be addressed in statute. I think giving the department the wiggle room or leeway, if you will, of a municipality showing good cause. The other thing is that I support the 20-year time frames and the 20-year extensions. I think that does, as you mentioned earlier, goes with good land use planning, as we have tried to exhibit. But the other thing is, coming from a city that went through this,
and with regards to figuring out where our water was going to come from, being in a critical water area, and having led that city through part of that process until we were able to finally start tapping into the Willamette River. It took from the time that the discussion started until the time that the tap was actually turned on, it took about 18 years. And that's going through good times and bad, and going through, you know, whether or not the river was polluted or not polluted. I mean, there's just a whole number of things that were involved in that conversation. I don't know that any other city could have done it any faster. I think that, and one of the other things is that we even had a water district that has been accused many times of wanting to take over the rest of the state, that was involved in the negotiations and sometimes helpful to the city and sometimes not. But I think that 20-year time frames are a lot more reasonable and a lot more realistic in terms of what municipalities have to go through when they're looking at changing or adding to their water sources. So for those reasons, I will support the Dash 1 amendments.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Bonhart and Representative Crummell have echoed my thoughts regarding the time period, the 10 years versus the 20 years. My concerns with the cities developing a good water management plan and benchmarks was somewhat answered regarding the administrative rules that are there in place. I just hope that they are follow through with those so that some of these issues don't come back again.
Thank you, Representative. And I think it's reasonably safe to say that if they don't follow those rules that they have written, it's just a remote chance that there will be another legislative session somewhere down the line that would be able to address that. Representative Galto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say briefly why I support this amendment. In my estimation, healthy communities are communities that are growing, and cities need adequate opportunities and tools at their disposal to plan for future growth. And growth is not a bad thing in my estimation, and we need the water to be able to allow that to occur. And so I support the cities being able to plan for the future, and that's why I'm supporting this measure.
Mr. Chair, I thank you for already heard in committee members the concerns I had on the Dash 1s, but I just wanted to say for the record that I absolutely support adequate planning timelines for cities, and I have too worked actually in a professional capacity on water plans and water conservation plans and permits, and I know that it takes quite a bit of time, and I'm not opposed to the 20-year time frame. It's really some of the other issues that were brought up that I do believe that we need to do adequate water supply planning, but it also has to be done in a way that also protects the resource. And that's the concern for me that still has been unanswered. I know that the department works hard, and I know that Adam does good work, and it's certainly not that I don't trust the department, but I think the resources for the department are not always going to be there, and I think that's another issue we have to make sure that they're adequately funded to make sure that there's technical assistance to communities that don't have the expertise, as we've seen with the City of Portland and the City of Bend, who have full-time staff working on this, but there's many other municipalities out there that do not have the expertise to do the adequate planning. So we have to make sure that the resources is adequately protected. So just wanted to get that on the record.
And thank you, Representative.
Again, thanks for all the good work of people here in the room.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I want to thank you for the patience that you've shown during the hearings when I've asked some questions.
You might get confused.
And I want to thank Adam also and the other people who have testified. I still have some serious questions, and I know the municipalities need assurance. They need to know how they're going to be planning for the future, and I can appreciate that. I guess the most compelling testimony for me was the woman from the League of Women Voters who said, remember that the water belongs to the citizens. And I keep coming back, I know, to the city of Adair Village, but it seems to me that that just is a very egregious example of someone claiming water that I think should be more duly given to the city of, or the state of Oregon, the citizens of Oregon. So I will be a no on the amendment.
If you want to, I'm in representative.
Zane Byrner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's, one thing that's extremely clear in the situation is that we have to have a fix for the current state of the law as it exists as a result of the court case. This bill has to go forward, and it needs to go to the Senate, where one would hope that some of these other issues are dealt with again, and perhaps in a slightly different way. Although I also will second what Representative Tomei has said, and the chair has been wonderful, and the witnesses who have presented this issue have done a great job, I think, of explicating what the problem is and what we need to do about it. I think the 20-year time frame is essential because it's the way that we get the land use law and the water law into concurrence with each other, which they need to be for planning purposes. I also agree with Representative Dalto that it's important for us to be planning for long-term growth, and that municipalities need to have access to adequate water, and they need to be able to plan for it long-term. If I thought that the chair needed a courtesy vote on the amendment and on the bill, I'd vote in favor of it. I don't think the chair does. So my vote is going to be no, but not because I don't believe this bill is important and that it needs actually to be in some small ways reworked, and then I'll be perfectly happy to vote for it on concurrence coming back from the Senate. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative, and thank all of the members of the committee for their patience as we have worked through this. And, you know, it's only one regret that I have with this, and that was the Willamette University or Lewis and Clark University or somebody from their law school wasn't here and collected money from you all, because this would have certainly been, a good creditor too in water law, as you have worked your way through this this particular bill, and it is a complex issue, and certainly everybody has some points, some legitimate points. I think one of the concerns the chair has, and it's been a concern for me this session in a couple of areas, a couple of places, and that is when there are work groups that are working on something, and and I don't know how to say this necessarily delicately or politely, but where somebody doesn't get exactly what they want, and then they walk away from the work group. Unfortunately, that may serve some merit, maybe of some merit for the goals and agendas of the work groups that might be involved, or members of the work group who might be involved in those projects, but it doesn't serve the agenda. And I repeat, it doesn't serve the agenda of developing good public policy as far as the state is concerned. And this is an area that we do need some fix on the public policy. And while there are parts of this bill that I'm not totally happy with, this is a step, I think, in the right direction. And as we pointed out a little bit earlier, there probably will be another legislative session 2, maybe even 4 or 6 years from now, that if some of that public policy turns out to be flawed and needs correction, that legislative session will be able to address the issue and will be able to proceed on with it. So I too, however, would like to thank all of the people who have been here and for their genuine help and effort, all the people who have testified on this bill, their help and effort in explaining to us a very complex issue and a very difficult problem for all of us. And in conclusion, I think this does go back, Karen, to whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting, and this is one of those cases, and we certainly will have the opportunity to have more of those cases, I'm sure, down the line.
I'll drink to that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
That'd be whiskey or water.
We're voting on the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3038.
Representative
Barnhart? No. Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
No.
Vice Chair Dingfelder?
No.
Vice Chair
Crimmel?
Aye.
Chair Jensen?
Aye.
And with that, do I have a motion? Representative Dalton.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3038 as amended to the House floor with a new pass recommendation.
Representative Dalton has moved House Bill 3038 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. You call the roll, please.
Representative Barnhart?
No.
Representative Brown?
Aye.
Representative Delto?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
No.
Vice Chair Dingfelder?
No.
Vice Chair Crummel?
Aye.
Chair Jensen?
Aye. House Bill 3038, as amended, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. The chair will carry the bill, unless somebody is dying to carry this bill.
You don't see me just talking. I'm already.
Okay. We'll move on. We will close then the work session on House Bill 3038, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3153 et al. For the this, and we would ask that Emil Wolf and Richard Kosasan. Yes, please, President Dalton.
Was it your intention, Mr. Chair, to move out House Bill 2907 today?
Not today.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Yes.
Chair calls Richard Kosasan and Emily Wolf. Okay. And for anybody else who's signed up for any of these, you understand all we're doing today, all the chair's interested in today is a, and I don't know whether you expect me to read that over the evening or not, but let me assure you I won't. The chair is interested for our hearing today on these bills to merely have the proponents and opponents, as the case may be, state what kind of generally is the issue and why we're bringing these bills forward and or why we shouldn't be bringing them forward, again, as the case may be.
I got another book.
At your pleasure.
Thank you, Chair Jensen and members of the committee. My name is Emily Wolf. I'm the Executive Director of Water for Life, Incorporated. We are a nonprofit organization that advocates for agricultural water users in the state of Oregon, and we are requesting this legislation, House Bill 3153. House Bill 3153 would...
I realize we're talking about all the bills.
It's not just 3153.
I was not aware of that, Chair Jensen. Thank you.
That's fine. Whatever. You know, go ahead.
Okay. On that note, then, I would like to speak to why Water for Life is bringing forward these bills. As you can see, they all relate to the issue of water right ownership. Water right ownership is of grave concern to our members. We have seen ownership of water rights come up in many situations, and they have requested that we pursue legislation to this degree to clarify that water rights do, in fact, belong to a landowner that owns the land to which the water right is appurtenant. The knowledge of the need for such legislation has been with this organization for several years. For those of you who were with us last session, Water for Life pursued a bill number 3298 that would have clarified that the owner of a water right is the appurtenant landowner. And we are back today with several bills that address the issues kind of surrounding this case. I know most of you have quite a good degree of background in this area, and I would answer a question that has been asked several times, and that is, why can't we just address the issues surrounding the issues of ownership? For instance, why can't we ask the question, why are people asking this question? And kind of go around the edges and clarify the issues of transfers and cancellations and point of diversion changes, etc., in an effort to kind of mollify people's concerns around the area of water right ownership. However, it doesn't address the foundational issue of who owns a water right. And as you will see through case law and case history, we believe very strongly that it is clear that the landowner that owns the appurtenant land owns that water right. This just provides a little bit of history on why we are pursuing this and why we think it is important. I would like to turn it over to our lobbyist, Richard Cosazan, with whom I'm sure you're all familiar, to answer your particular technical questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Cosazan.
Thank you, Chair Jensen. For the record, Richard Cosazan, Water for Life. Before you truly are a series of four or five bills, 3153, 3155, 3156, 3204, and 3255. As Ms. Wolf indicated, all directly or indirectly deal with the ongoing debate over, quote, ownership, and I think that extends beyond ownership to the ultimate management or control of a water right. And, Mr. Chair, briefly, I will reach back a few years, and I anticipate that you would like to conclude very shortly.
Not too awfully long, yeah. I kind of have a 3 o'clock agenda for everybody today. So.
Okay. We will be as brief as we can. This issue has really arisen during the last five-year period. In 99 and 2000, a number of individual patrons within the Grants Pass Irrigation District desired to cancel their rights, and that is a cancellation proceeding in accordance with 540.621. And that was a debate that arose within the district. Grants Pass Irrigation District came forth and said no to the patrons, you shall not cancel your rights without our approval. The debate continued. It culminated in a number of situations, but one was a opinion issued by the Attorney General in September of 2000. And that speaks specifically to the issue of control, ownership of a water right, specifically with respect to cancellation proceedings. The AG opinion is in your packet, and that is noted under tab 1
I think it's a very interesting opinion in the sense that it speaks to the ownership question for an individual outside an irrigation district, inside an irrigation district, and furthermore, inside a Federal Bureau of Reclamation project. And I think that AG opinion is very much on point, suggesting that the landowner is the one who controls and owns that water right, and it's his or her choice to seek cancellation, and it is not a prerequisite that that landowner obtain the permission of a district. For background, I would again suggest that's a fairly interesting opinion. That situation was followed by a similar but yet different situation arising in Fort Vinoy Irrigation District. In that case, an individual patron desired to transfer his point of diversion. That information is found in tab 3 and tab 4. Again, the district, Fort Vinoy, suggested to the individual patron that the individual patron needed or was required to obtain the permission of the district before a transfer would move forward. You will see in the briefs filed and in the packet, these are briefs from the Water Resources Department, spelling out the situation, spelling out the arguments, and basically finding, as the first brief indicates, in essence, the district is claiming that it is the co-owner of the water right appurtenant to an applicant's land. Therefore, applicant must obtain the district's consent of the applicant's consent from the district. Those two briefs, as you will see in the first, the conclusion reached by the department itself, protestants' claims of injury and an ownership interest that gives the district veto power over the proposed transfer are not well taken. The department is entitled to a ruling in its favor on the issue of injury because protestants' claimed loss of carry water in the district delivery system does not amount to a legally cognizable claim of injury. Followed by the ruling on the legal issues, and this was from the hearings officer panel, that is in tab 4, and again, that upholds the first. So we had the first situation in Grants Pass. We moved to a situation of Fort Vinoy. Those are two outside, very clear-cut, I believe, situations. The debate continued. In 2001, legislation was introduced, and it was noted as House Bill 2539, which would have afforded districts the ability to claim water and give the districts first call on water that was otherwise subject to appropriation resulting from a cancellation. That's similar to legislation that has been discussed before the committee this session. We continued, as Emily said earlier, last session, House Bill 3298 was introduced. It was, I think, fair to say it was widely discussed and debated. It passed, I think it passed two houses. I think it passed the House twice and never was considered by the Senate, so I guess that doesn't really count. But you have that in your packet also. Opponents of the effort to clarify this issue, I think in recent years, have suggested that there is case law or a prevalence of case law over the last 100-year period that would uphold a district's ability to lay claim or control a water right of a district patron. In tab 5, there is a summary of what we believe to be the pertinent case law. And I think if one were to take a very close look at the case law that's been developed from the early 1900s through recent years, you will find that the courts believe very clearly in Oregon, as well as most Western states, water remains appurtenant to the land upon which it's beneficially applied, and the landowner is the one owning or controlling that right. Chair Jensen.
Thank you. I just wanted to let you know you had a minute to conclude.
1 minute to conclude. Mr. Chair, I would encourage the committee to specifically look at tab 7 in terms of a discussion of who owns a water right, and the other tabs would include 3298, Senate Bill 590, again discussed, and two interesting pieces. Irrespective of action on the bills in front of the committee, I think there's a better way to address this issue. And I would very much encourage the members of the committee to look at the statutory provisions found at 540.210. And the last attachment you have in your packet, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I just probably exceeded my minute, but I'm hurrying, is you will find two pages noted as pages 338 and 339. And those are pages out of the 1909 Water Code. You will find that those reflect similar provisions at 540.210. And I think, again, as I said, I think there's a better way to address this ongoing debate. There has to be a mutual agreement and a mutual action. And if the committee were inclined, I think something could be structured around those two statutory provisions, one current and one nearly 100 years old. With that, Mr. Chair, I would be happy to try to answer any questions or get up and leave at your preference.
Thank you, Richard. We will forego questions right now unless there's something specific and ask Anita Winkler and Phil, is it fine if they would come up? And for the members of the committee who were not in the Water Committee last time, this would be Water Law 102 in the event we can find somebody to give it the credit. For those who were here last time and went through this issue, we'd move it to a graduate level offering then this time. So with this, Anita, if you would please.
I'm a little uncomfortable following that statement. I'm not sure I'm up to your billing here. For the record, I'm Anita Winkler. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Water Resources Congress. We represent irrigation districts and other special districts that provide irrigation water in Oregon. With me is Phil Fine, who is, I brought Phil along to answer questions that I can't answer. Phil is a water user and a district board member with the North Unit Irrigation District in Madras. So I thought somebody who knows more about irrigation district operations hands-on would might be helpful to the committee. So I do not have prepared testimony. So I'm going to kind of quickly go through this graduate level course, if you will, relying on the students to have read and prepared fully in advance of the lecture. How's that? I will say that I agree with Water for Life on one statement they made, and that is that this is about ownership. Ownership is about management and control of the water rights. But the disagreement stops there. We don't see...
You say the disagreement?
Excuse me, the agreement stops there.
Okay.
This is easier than I thought.
Thank you. That's a piece of cake.
It's only Monday and it's
sorry, I didn't call a work session for today.
We don't believe either party has full management or full control, either party being the district or the water user, landowner, however you want to define that. We call them patrons, members. There's a multiple set of terms. We believe it's a shared interest. One can't exist without the other. The water right requires diversion, delivery, and being put to beneficial use. The district does part of that. The water user, landowner, farmer does the other part. It's just a symbiotic relationship. One would hope it's at least as constructive as symbiotic. At times, I'm not sure it is. Irrigation districts are local governments. They're special districts. They're governed by locally elected officials who are responsible to the patrons in the district. Those patrons elected to form that district. These aren't districts that were imposed upon them. Those landowners chose to be part of a district in order to be able to divert and prove up the water in order to irrigate. In some places, the costs for that are beyond imagination for any one individual to be able to do it. It could only be done by several hundred water users or farmers, potential farmers, getting together and putting their resources and their energy collectively together. To me, declaring that the water rights belong to the landowner are not unlike, if you will, stretching an analogy, in a fire district, another special district, of declaring that the fire truck belongs to the patrons of the district because they've paid for it through their taxes. And to begin to peel the water rights off, it would be not unlike taking a wheel off and giving it to one person and a ladder to somebody, and it only takes one or two actions, and pretty soon that truck's not worth anything and can't do its job. When you begin peeling water rights away from a district, pretty soon the district isn't functional. You can't move the water, and you don't have the financial wherewithal to maintain the district. I could sit here and argue point.
Anita, I'm still back in 101. How are districts originally formed?
Chair Jensen, Representative Tomei, they're formed by an election. It's a petition and then an election by the landowners who are in the district.
Who, may I follow up? Who grants them that power to do that?
Statute.
Thank
Oregon State statute.
Okay, thank you.
It might be important for members to note that those may go back to 18-aught-something or another. They go back a long ways in some cases as far as some water districts are.
Yes, some of these districts
and
are well over 100 years old.
May, in fact, have been a handshake as far as the agreements were concerned when they were first formed.
Chair Jensen, they were a handshake if they were formed as a private entity and then converted later. If they were formed as an irrigation district, they had to have a formal election. And good many of them were originally formed as private ditch companies who then converted over through an election of those landowners.
Representative Barnard.
Thank you. Again, this is a one-on-one question. When you say election, are you talking about a majority vote, or are you talking about the agreement of all the landowners that they wanted to be a part of this organization?
Chair Jensen and Representative Barnhart, I think I just failed 101. I don't know. I know that people can elect out. I'd have to get back to you with the actual answer for that.
Election could mean either thing, and that's why I asked
you
the
know,
question.
Good point, and I'd have to get back, and I'll get back to you on that.
Thank you.
Let's and not get too complicated for me here. Can we get on to he's come a long ways, and we're going to run out of time, and I do want to hear Scott's comments before we leave for today. So do you mind, Anita?
No, that's fine.
Thank you. If you would, Mr. Franklin.
Chairman Jensen, representatives, I basically came here to answer any questions that you all might have as concerning how our irrigation district operates and what we do. With that in mind, though, I will address probably our major concern as far as not only a farmer but a board member in an irrigation district that consists of 63 miles of main canal and 260 miles of laterals that services 58,900 acres, roughly, in central Oregon. You know, with that, we are a conveyance district, and with that in mind, you know, our sole purpose is to deliver that water, and we have to deliver it a long ways, and that is becoming quite expensive. And our problem with some of these ownership bills is not so much who owns the water right, but as to whether a district should have some sort of say on a managerial standpoint what you can or can't do with the water within the district boundaries. The worst case scenario is pretty soon you start transferring water out. Maybe some of the smaller farms, they sell the water off. They're out of the district. They're off of the books. There's no longer an assessment on these acres. And it's an assessment-driven district. That's the only way we can fund our operations is through assessments, and it's basically on a per-acre basis. We have roughly 860 patrons, ranging from a quarter of an acre to the cap of 960 in a I guess I should clarify, ours is a federal bureau project. And as you can see, with our costs have been rising steadily just like everybody else's. But our biggest fear is that with a decrease in acres, you have farmers who are struggling as it is, having to make up more of a share of the cost of running the district. And eventually, you no longer have a district because nobody can afford the water. And therefore, we're all out of business. And I think that's pretty much what I needed to say today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And if we can, then move on to Scott, would you? And this is Katie Faster. Mm.
Katie's here.
Two of you come up. Farm Bureau and Cattlemen, are they both here? Please, Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Scott Ashkin with the Oregon Agricultural Alliance. This is Water Law 10 that I'm going to give it. The owner, who owns a water right? Please bear in mind that water rights have two important components. The point of diversion, or where the water is diverted from a stream or a river or a well. A water right also includes a component of the place of use, the field where the water is put to use in the case of the irrigation water right. To say that the owner of the water right might be the owner of the land, which is appurtenant to the place of use, but not the owner of the water right, which is appurtenant to the point of diversion, is absurd. The owner of a water right is the owner of the point of diversion and the place of use. Let me just give you an example of a case that is current right now. I have a client that has a certificated water right subject to transfer. They transferred 20 acres of the place of use of their water right onto 20 acres of property across the road from the home place. They convey the water from the well on the home place, the point of diversion, across the road. They lease the 20 acres of ground from the neighbor across the road and use that land under lease as their place of use for their irrigation water right. This lease went on in effect for 5 years. The owners of that property passed away. Their successors in ownership of that property never had a lease for the water to be used on their own property. The Water Resource Department, the owner of the water right wants now to transfer that 20 acres of water right, the place of use, back to the home place. The Water Resource Department says that they have to have permission of the new property owners across the road to transfer their water back to their property, because the department apparently is attributing some kind of ownership to the water right, which is being used at the place of use under the transfer for the certificated water right on the home place. The department is attributing some kind of ownership to that lease that existed with the previous landowners who have now passed away. Now, if the landowner denies their permission to transfer that water right back, then they put a bunch of people between a rock and a hard place. They put the department, potentially subject to a big dollar litigation by forcing eventually cancellation of that water right for non-use and forfeiture. Just all kinds of problems arise if you don't consider the owner of the water right to be the owner of both the point of diversion and the place of use. I just give that to you for your consideration, and thank you for the opportunity.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony and input on this. We'll maybe have occasion to probe that a little more as we go along. And we have kind of run out of time. Has your position changed on this issue, Katie?
Representative Jensen, thanks. Our position on the ownership has stayed the same from last session. Farm Bureau's position is that water rights are pertinent to the land, and therefore the owner of the water right is the owner of the land, and be happy to come back Wednesday and talk about some of these bills in more detail if you'd like.
Okay.
Chair Jensen, Kate Teasel with the Oregon Cattlemen Association. We concur with the Oregon Farm Bureau.
Okay. Thank you all very much for your brevity. We appreciate that here today, and we're rapidly losing members, so we are adjourned.